In the Senate of the United States, a resolution to establish a select committee of the Senate to conduct an investigation and study of the extent, if any, to which illegal, improper, or unethical activities were engaged in by any persons acting individually or in combination with others in the presidential election of 1972, or any campaign, canvass, or other activity related to it.
Totally a new ball game, and essentially that was what I was trying for, to get sort of back up and start all over again with a fair trial, which was not transpiring because of the perjured testimony that occurred, and because some were going to trial and some were not. And as I said in the testimony, this didn't appear to me to be the proper form of American justice. Whether I would have, at what point in time I would have told the story is a totally different matter, and it would have been under totally different circumstances. They're difficult to compare.
Michael Schoffler adds more detail on how the Watergate burglars were arrested. Then one of them, McCord, said he took part only because he was told the operation was approved by the then Attorney General, John Mitchell. In the second hour, McCord testifies that E. Howard Hunt and John Caulfield pressured him to stay silent after his arrest. He said the offers included cash for bail, executive clemency, and aid for his family. He said the offers were made in the name of the White House. Under questioning in the third hour, McCord said that G. Gordon Liddy told him that John Mitchell liked what the telephone taps were producing and wanted a broken one fixed. And later in the hearing, in the fourth hour, McCord said that the committee to re-elect the president got intelligence reports from the Justice Department almost on a daily basis. He said Assistant Attorney General Robert Mardian helped him get these. Now let's go to the hearings, which Senator Sam Ervin gaveled open.
Thank you. Counsel, call the next witness.
Mr. James McCord.
Mr. McCord, raise your right hand. You swear the evidence you shall give to the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Mr. McCord, would you bring the microphone closer to you so that we can all hear? I know your voice is... Now, for the record, would you first state your name and address?
James W. McCord, M-C-C-O-R-D, Jr. The address is number 7, Winder, W-I-N-D-E-R, Winder Court, Rockville, Maryland, 20850.
Now, are you accompanied with counsel this morning?
I am.
Will counsel please identify himself?
Yes, my name is Bernard Fenstewall, Jr. My business address is 910 16th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C.
Mr. McCord, prior to your testimony, do you have any preliminary statement you may wish to make to the committee?
Yes, there is. I would like to state, as I did when I appeared at the executive session of this committee, that I'd like to be as accurate as I can, that some of the dates that I will refer to, there are approximately 75 to 100 different dates. I will try to recall to the best of my memory. Some may be inaccurate. As I stated when I first appeared, some matters go back some 12 to 14 months, and some of the matters that are of interest to this committee, I therefore set forth in writing, attempting to reconstruct my memory to the best of my ability. I may refer to some of those memoranda during this meeting and to other notes that pertain to dates, and I hope you will bear with me and understand the reason in that regard. I will state finally that my participation in the Watergate operation on my part, for whatever reasons I may have had at the time, whatever rationale I may have had at the time, was an error, was a mistake, and a very grave mistake, which I regret. I'm ready to proceed with the questions.
All right. Is it a fact now, Mr. McCord, that you presently stand convicted on a multi-count federal indictment charging burglary, electronic surveillance, and conspiracy arising out of the break-in of the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate?
That's correct.
And are you now awaiting sentence on that conviction?
That is correct.
What is your professional background, Mr. McCord?
I was born in 1924 in Waurika, W-A-U-R-I-K-A, Waurika, Oklahoma. I worked first for the Federal Bureau of Investigation in 1942-1943 in Washington, D.C. and New York City in radio intelligence duties. I subsequently, in 43-45, was an Air Force, was an Army Air Corps officer. From 1948-1951, I worked as a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation in San Diego and San Francisco, California. I worked from 1951-1970 with the Central Intelligence Agency as a security officer. I retired from that agency in August 1970 after 25 years federal service. Do you want the educational background or not?
No, that's sufficient, Mr. McCord. During your service with the CIA or the FBI, did you receive any awards or commendations for your service?
I received on retirement in August 1970 the Distinguished Service Award for Outstanding Performance of Duty with CIA.
Now, prior to your arrest, indictment, and conviction relating to the Watergate incident, were you ever arrested, charged with a crime, or the subject of any complaint or disciplinary proceeding in your life?
I've had traffic violations in the Washington area. Yes, sir.
Ticket. Is that all?
Yes, sir.
Now, were you an employee of the committee to reelect the president?
I was.
What position did you hold? And what were your duties?
I came aboard first as a security consultant part-time in September 1971.
And by the way, how did you get that job?
I was introduced initially by Mr. John Caulfield to Mr. Robert Odle, the Director of Administration, who testified yesterday. And based on that interview, was employed part-time and then full-time in January, the 1st of January, 1972.
Now, what were your duties in that position as security chief?
The duties were essentially the function of the protection of the property and the lives of the personnel of the committee in their facility there, and subsequently in the facility at Miami, Florida, that the committee and some of the White House staff were to occupy during the Republican National Convention in August of 1972. The duties were primarily those of physical security protection, of personnel security, some document security, and some protective work for the family of John Mitchell.
Now, for those duties and that assignment that you just described, under whose direction did you work?
Primarily under the direction of Mr. Robert Odle, who was my immediate supervisor in the committee. The responsibilities with Mr. Mitchell and his family, I received directions from him, from Mrs. Mitchell, from Robert Odle, and from Fred LaRue at various times.
Now, did there come a time when you worked under the direction of Gordon Liddy?
Yes, sir, did.
What was Mr. Liddy's position at that time?
He was at first from December until about March 1970, December 71 to about March 1972, general counsel for the committee to reelect the president. Thereafter, he was occupied the same position with the finance committee for the reelection of the president.
When did this arrangement or in which you worked under his direction begin, Mr. McCord? Mr. Liddy?
The first discussions of the arrangement began sometime in January 1972, early January.
Could you briefly state for the committee, Mr. McCord, what it was that Mr. Liddy wanted you to do?
I can give a bit of a background if you want that. When he first came aboard the committee in December 1971, he began to, we struck up an acquaintance. We'd had a common background. And he began to question me regarding the state of the art of certain technical devices, for one thing, listening devices and so on. This appeared to be, at that point in time, a professional interest, a normal professional interest of someone who's worked in the field or law enforcement. We discussed as well the common topic of common interest to he and to me and to others who were senior in the staff of the anticipated demonstrations and possible violence that might be coming up in San Diego, California, which was originally scheduled to be the convention site for the Republican convention in 1972 in August. The discussions on
raise
other...
your voice a
yes.
little if you can, Mr. McCord.
The discussions on other matters...
I can interrupt just for a minute, Mr. McCord. I believe it might help. The panel operator might give us some advice in this respect if you could be a little further away from the microphone and talk a little louder, because we're having a difficult time up here trying to hear you.
I think I'm a bit hoarse. If you could turn up the volume, that might help.
Would you continue?
Yes. Gradually, the discussion in December, January, February 1972 with Mr. Liddy gradually developed into more and more conversation on his part with me in the offices of the Committee for the Re-election of the President regarding technical devices and political matters pertaining to the forthcoming convention, and it became apparent that he had an interest in several areas of intelligence gathering pertaining to the Democratic Party and the Democratic Convention, and in which it was contemplated or planned by him and by others whom he referred to in these conversations as John Mitchell, John Dean, counsel to the President, Jeb Magruder, then in January, the interim director of the Committee to Re-elect the President, in which it appeared that those men, the four of them, were in a, by late January, a planning stage in which political intelligence was to be discussed at meetings in the Attorney General's office, Mr. Mitchell's office, and in which Mr. Liddy was seeking from me certain information regarding the costs and the types of electronic devices that could be used in bugging, that a part of the budget proposal which he was working on, a second part dealt with photography operations, clandestine photography operations, and that a third part dealt with the broad area of political espionage, political intelligence.
Well, now, specifically, Mr. McCord, when you speak of political activities, political intelligence, bugging activities, what do you mean in terms of how that was to be obtained? Try to be as specific as you can from your knowledge of what Mr. Liddy told you.
The area of political espionage and intelligence, he did not, I can set that one aside pretty quickly, he did not elaborate on in much detail at all to me personally. Apparently others were involved with him, which I can refer to later in the conversation, specifically Mr. Hunt, E. Howard Hunt. The topic of photography, clandestine photography, in which he was preparing a budget and preparing to meet with the gentleman I've referred to before in planning sessions, dealt with photographic equipment and the cost of photographic equipment and specific items of equipment that would be used against the Democratic Party, the Democratic hierarchy in Washington primarily, but also in Miami, Florida. The electronic devices, which he referred to specifically, were of a variety of types,
asking specifically what the types were, but how were they to be used, where were they to be placed, from your understanding?
The initial interest specified by Mr. Liddy in this regard were, number one, against Mr. Larry O'Brien, then chairman of the Democratic National Committee in Washington, D.C., at his residence and subsequently at his office in the Watergate office building. Perhaps other offices of the Democratic National Committee. The McGovern headquarters in Washington, D.C. were mentioned quite early in 1972. And there was some general reference to the Democratic National Convention facility or site, wherever it might be located, at their convention in the summer of 1972.
All right, now, Mr. McCord, in connection with this assignment, in which you were having these discussions with Mr. Liddy, did you come to associate yourself with Mr. E. Howard Hunt, Bernard Barker, Eugene Martinez, Frank Sturgis, and Virgil Gonzalez?
Yes, I did.
And as a result of that association and your agreement with Mr. Liddy, did you, with Mr. Barker, Sturgis, Martinez, and Gonzalez, illegally enter the Democratic National Committee headquarters on two occasions, one on or about May 30, 1972, and the other in the early morning hours of June 17, 1972?
I did.
On the first occasion, on or about May 30, 1972, did you install two telephone interception devices, or wiretaps, on two office telephones, one on the telephone of Spencer Oliver and the other on the telephone of Lawrence O'Brien?
I did.
Leaving aside for the time being why you broke into the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate the second time on June 17, and what circumstances led to your arrest, you were in fact arrested by plainclothesmen of the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police shortly after you entered. Is that true?
That's correct.
And is that arrest which led to your present conviction?
That's correct.
Could you tell the committee, Mr. McCord, why, after a lifetime of work as a law enforcement officer, without, as you testified, any blemish on your career, did you agree with Mr. Liddy to engage in his program of burglaries and illegal wiretapping, and specifically the two break-ins on May 30 and June 17th at the Democratic National Committee headquarters at Watergate?
There were a number of reasons associated with the ultimate decision of mine to do so. One of the reasons, and a very important reason to me, was the fact that the Attorney General himself, Mr. John Mitchell, at his offices had considered and approved the operation, according to Mr. Liddy. Secondly, that the counsel for the President, Mr. John Dean, had participated in those decisions with him, that one was a top legal officer for the United States in the Department of Justice, and the second gentleman was a top legal officer in the White House, that the matter had apparently been given...
Stop there, if you will, just for a second. I noticed you said that Mr. Mitchell had approved, according to Liddy. Do you have personal knowledge of Mr. Dean's participation, or was this also according to Mr. Liddy?
Mr. Dean's participation came to me through two sources. One was Mr. Liddy. One was Mr. Hunt, E. Howard Hunt, in discussions which subsequently came to me.
I might say, if I may, Mr. Chairman, that we have no desire to try to impede the progress of your testimony, or to try to adhere strictly to the rules of evidence, such as the hearsay rule, which would otherwise apply in a court of law. But it would be helpful to me, and I believe to the committee, if in each instance
and information you give us is not of your own personal first-hand knowledge, you would identify it as such and give us the source.
Yes, sir. I believe I was responding to a question of the counsel that what were my reasons, which involved, in my case, a conclusion and motivation and intent as opposed to what someone else had told me.
We are here as much as possible to rules of evidence which have been established and used in all the courts. And I would say that your testimony is to the effect that you were assured by Mr. Liddy that John Mitchell and John Dean and Zeb Magruder had approved Mr. Liddy's proposed operations. And you also received assurance not only as to Mr. Dean from Mr. Liddy, but also from Mr. Hunt. That was based on what you were told by Mr. Liddy and Mr. Hunt.
That is correct, sir.
I would say that under the rules of evidence, this at the present stage of this hearing would not be admissible to show the connection, any connection with this matter by John Mitchell, John Dean, Jeb Magruder, but the testimony which Mr. McCord has given is relevant to show the motives which prompted Mr. McCord to participate in the matter.
Yes, sir, I'll explain. I am not a lawyer. I'm a layman. I will try to give the information of my knowledge, whether it's firsthand or secondhand, to the benefit of this committee, and you can stop me at what point you may feel it's proper to do so.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just elaborate that point, I thoroughly agree with the statement made by the chairman. I associate myself with him as to his content and form. And I, once again, am not trying to impede the progress of your testimony. It would be very helpful to us, however, if, when information is not first-hand information, you would identify it so we can simply note it for our records to that effect.
I'd be glad to do so.
Thank you, sir.
Now, did you...
Would you proceed?
Certainly, I'd be glad to. Sometime in July 1972, shortly after I got out of jail, which was in June 1972, about midday, there was a note in my mailbox at my residence. And when I opened the letter, which had not been stamped nor sent through the mails, it was a note from Jack Caulfield, signed Jack, which said, "Go to the phone booth on Route 355 near your home," and he gave three alternate times at which I could appear at the phone booth for a telephone call from him. To the best of my recollection, one of those times was very shortly thereafter, an hour or two later, and another time was the next day, and it seems to me that the third time was the following evening. I went to the telephone, to that telephone booth on Route 355 that afternoon, the same afternoon, as I best recall, and I heard the voice that I have referred to in this memorandum of today. I do not know the individual's identity. He had an accent that I would refer to as a New York accent. He said that he had formerly worked with Jack Caulfield. He said that I'm a friend of Jack's. I formerly worked with him. Jack will want to talk with you shortly. He will be in touch with you soon. I received a call subsequently from Mr. Caulfield. To the best of my recollection, it came to my home first, and it said, "Go to the same phone booth on Route 355, which I did. And there Mr. Caulfield told me that he was going overseas in a few days. He said, "If you have any problems, if you have any problems, call my home and leave word, and I will call you back from overseas to your residence." He said, "When you call
my home. Ask for Mr. Watson. Watson, W-A-T-S-O-N. He said also, after I return, if you ever need to call me at my office, he gave a number, the office number, and he said, simply leave word that Mr. Watson is calling. So it was a name that both of us were to use, my name and his name. I did not contact him during the next 30 days, and I next heard from him, to the best of my recollection, sometime in September 1972, on a Sunday afternoon. I can't recall the exact date, but I do recall that Mr. Clark McGregor, then the head of the Committee for the Re-election of the President, had just finished a television appearance on one of the talk programs such as Meet the Press. And Mr. Caulfield called me at home and again asked that I go to the telephone booth on Route 355, which I did. He stated that he'd had trouble getting my home phone number because it was an unlisted number. And he stated, quote, "We are worried about you." This is Mr. Caulfield's statement. And he went on then to read briefly the words of a deposition which he planned to give to the Democratic National Committee. I had read in the papers a few days before that he had been scheduled as a witness before the Democratic National Committee. And he read the deposition to me, indicating that this was, in effect, what he planned to say in the deposition. There was some reference during the conversation to something doing with a double agent, in quotes. Mr. Clark McGregor, as I recalled, in his television appearance, had referred to the possibility of there being a double agent in the Watergate operation, and the inference was that it was Mr. Baldwin. And I told Mr. Caulfield that, so far as I was concerned, whoever had drawn that conclusion had drawn an absolutely erroneous conclusion, that I had seen absolutely nothing that would indicate such, and I simply wanted to go on the record with Mr. Caulfield to that effect.
Well, we do want to get back to the statement, but in short, what you're saying is that Mr. Caulfield's friend Watson, by name, is the man whose voice you heard that...
No, sir, that's, most respectfully, that's not what I said, sir.
Go on.
I believe Mr. Caulfield used the name Watson. It was not his friend.
I see.
Yes, sir.
Go on. Go on. Well, how many times did you hear this unidentified voice?
To the best of my recollection, I heard the voice prior to the January call two or three times. I cannot be absolutely sure, but at least twice before January.
Were these in connection with contacts with Caulfield?
Always.
Yes. That's what I meant.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Now, we can proceed with the statement from where you left off, Mr. McCord, and I guess the prior sentence, so we have continuity.
I believe my last sentence that I read was that the same message was once again repeated, obviously read. I believe that appears in the statement that you have on page 3. The next sentence was that I told the caller that I would not discuss such matters over the telephone, and he stated that Mr. Caulfield was out of town. On Wednesday, January 10th, 1973, the same party, to the best of my recollection, called and told me by phone that Jack would want to talk with me by phone on Thursday night, the following night, January 11th, when he got back into town, and requested that I go to the same phone booth on Route 355 near the Blue Fountain Inn. He also conveyed instructions regarding a personal meeting with Mr. Caulfield on Friday night, January 12th. On Thursday evening, January 11th, the same party called me at home and told me that Caulfield's plane was late and wanted, and that he, speaking of Caulfield, wanted to meet with me personally the same evening, that is, Thursday evening after arrival. I told him that I would not do so, but would meet with him on Friday night if he desired. Later that evening, the same evening, Thursday evening, about 9:30 p.m., Caulfield called me on my home phone and insisted on talking with me, but my family refused to let him do so since I was asleep. On Friday night, January 12, from about 7 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., I met with Caulfield at the second overlook, that is, overlooking the Potomac. It's a parking area overlooking the Potomac River on George Washington Parkway in Virginia.
Mr. Gordon, how did that meeting be arranged? How did you know to go there?
It was, as previously stated, I believe, on the Wednesday call, to the best of my recollection, in which this unidentified party had said that Caulfield will want to meet with you personally, and he said, on Friday night, go to the second overlook on George Washington Parkway, and he specified a time, and that is what I followed through with. I met with Caulfield at the second overlook on George Washington Parkway, that is, the second one leaving Washington going out in Virginia, and talked with him in his car, in his automobile. Caulfield advised that he had been attending a law enforcement meeting in San Clemente, California, and had just returned. I advised him that I had no objection to meeting with him, to tell him my frame of mind, but that I had no intention of talking executive clemency or pleading guilty, that I had come to the meeting at his request and not of my own, and I was glad to tell him my views. He said that the offer of executive clemency, which he was passing along, and of support while in prison and rehabilitation, and help toward a job later, quote, was a sincere offer, unquote. He explained that he had been asked to convey this message to me, and he was only doing what he was told to do. He repeated this last statement several times during the course of the meeting that we had then, and I might add during subsequent meetings which he and I had. My response was that I would not even discuss executive clemency or pleading guilty and remaining silent, but I was glad to talk with him so that there was no misunderstanding on anyone's part about it. I might explain that the trial was going on during this period. This was the first week of the trial, which began on January 8th. Caulfield stated that he was carrying the message of executive clemency to me, quote, from the very highest levels of the White House, unquote. He stated that the President of the United States was in Key Biscayne, Florida, that weekend, referring to the weekend following January 8th, or following the meeting that we were then in, that the President had been told of the forthcoming meeting with me and would be immediately told of the results of the meeting.
The same rule previously announced, this evidence is competent to show what, if anything, John Caulfield did to induce Mr. McCord to plead guilty and keep silent. It is not any evidence in his present state of the hearing that makes any connection whatever, has any relevancy as to the President.
Precisely. Yes, sir. He further stated that, quote, I may have a message to you at our next meeting from the President himself, unquote. I advised Caulfield that I had seen the list of witnesses for the trial and had seen Jeb Magruder's name appearing as a government witness. I advised him that it was clear then that Magruder was going to perjure himself and that we were not going to get a fair trial. Further, I told him that it was clear that some of those involved in the Watergate case were going to trial and others were going to be covered for. Parenthesis, I was referring to John Mitchell, John Dean, and Magruder, parenthesis closed, and I so named those individuals incidentally during the conversation. And I said that this was not my idea of American justice. I further advised...
The same ruling, yes, applies, sir, as far as John Mitchell, John Dean, and Magruder is concerned. That is, does not connect them, legally speaking.
Yes, sir. I further advised Caulfield... Yes, sir. I further advised Caulfield that I believe that the government had lied in denying electronic interception of my phone calls from my residence since June 17, 1972, and that I believe that the administration had also tapped the phones of the other defendants during that time. I mentioned two specific calls of mine which I had made during September and early October 1972, which I was certain had been intercepted by the government, and yet the government had blithely denied any such tapping. These were my words to Mr. Caulfield. I compared this denial to the denial the government had made in the Ellsberg case, in which for months the government had denied any such impermissible interception of calls, and yet in the summer of 1972 had finally been forced to admit them when a judge ordered by court order a search of about a dozen government agencies, and calls intercepted were then disclosed. I might state, separate from the record at this point, that, as I have previously stated, I had no knowledge whatever of any activity, monitoring, or what have you, of Mr. Ellsberg calls, as have previously come out, as have earlier come out in the newspapers in the past few days. It's purely coincidence that I happened to mention the Ellsberg case at that time. I had been following the case in the papers, and I knew the history of the case. To go on with the statement, I stated that if we were going to get a fiction of a fair trial through perjured testimony to begin with, and then for the government to lie about illegal telephone interceptions, that the trial ought to be kicked out and we start all over again, this time with all of those involved as defendants. At least in this way, quote, some would not be more equal than others, unquote, before the bar of justice, and we would get a fair trial. The executive clemency offer was made two or three times during this meeting, as I recall, and I repeated each time that I would not even discuss it, nor discuss pleading guilty, which I had been asked to do in the first telephone call received on the night of January 8th from Caulfield's friend, whose identity I do not know. I told him, referring to Mr. Caulfield, that I was going to renew the motion on disclosure of government wiretapping of our telephones. Caulfield ended the conversation by stating that he would call me the next day about a meeting that same afternoon, Saturday, January 13, and that if I did not hear from him, he would want to talk with me by telephone on the evening of Monday, January 15, 1973. I did not hear from Caulfield on Saturday, but on Sunday afternoon, he called and asked to meet me that afternoon about an hour later at the same location on George Washington Parkway. He stated that there was no objection to renewing the motion on discovery of government wiretapping, and if that failed, that I would receive executive clemency after 10 to 11 months. I told him that I had not asked anyone's permission to file the motion. He went on to say that, quote, the president's ability to govern is at stake. Another teapot dome scandal is possible, and the government may fall. Everybody else is on track but you. You are not following the game plan. Get closer to your attorney. You seem to be pursuing your own course of action. Don't talk if called before the grand jury. Keep silent.
and do the same if called before a congressional committee, unquote. I might add that two congressional committees had prior to January 9th, prior to that date, been conducting investigations into this case. I believe it was the Patman Committee and the Senator Patman's committees. My response was that I felt a massive injustice was being done, that I was different from the others, that I was going to fight the fixed case, and I had no intention of either pleading guilty, taking executive clemency, or agreeing to remain silent. He repeated the statement that the government would have difficulty in continuing to be able to stand. I responded that they do have a problem, but that I had a problem with the massive injustice of the whole trial being a sham, and that I would fight it every way I know. I should make a correction in the sentence that I've just read when I say the whole trial being a sham, because I did not at that point in time make any reference at any time to Judge Sirica. I made just the contrary of his being anything but an honest and a dedicated judge, and I don't want the sentence to be misread. He, talking about Caulfield, asked for a commitment that I would remain silent, and I responded I would make none. I gave him a memorandum on the dates of the two calls of mine in September 1972 and October 1972 that I was sure had been intercepted, and said that I believed the government had lied about them. He said that he would check and see if, in fact, the government had done so. On Monday night, January 15th, 1973, Caulfield called me again at the phone booth on Route 355 near my residence. I informed him that I had no desire to talk further, that if the White House had any intention of playing the game straight and giving us a semblance of a fair trial, they would check into the perjury charge of mine against Magruder, and into the existence of the two intercepted calls previously referred to, and I hung up. On Tuesday morning, the next morning, about 7:30, Mr. Caulfield called my residence, but had already left for court. On Tuesday evening, Caulfield called and asked me again to meet with him, and I responded not until after they had something to talk about on the perjured testimony and the intercepted calls. He said words to the effect, give us a week, and a meeting was subsequently arranged on January 25, 1973, when he said he would have something to talk about. About 10 a.m. on Thursday, January 25, 1973, in a meeting lasting until about 12:30 a.m., the correction, 12:30 p.m., we drove in his car toward Warrenton, Virginia, and returned. That is, we drove there and returned. And a conversation ensued which repeated the offers of executive clemency and financial support while in prison and rehabilitation later. I refused to discuss it. He stated that I was, quote, fouling up the game plan, unquote. And I made a few comments about the game plan. He stated that, quote, they, unquote, had found no record of the interception of the two calls I referred to, and said that perhaps it could wait until the appeals. He asked what my plans were regarding talking publicly, and I said that I planned to do so when I was ready, that I had discussed it with my wife, and she said that I should do what I felt I must and not to worry about the family. I advised Jack that my children were now grown and could understand what I had to do when the disclosures came out. He responded by saying, quote, you know that if the administration gets its back to the wall, it will have to take steps to defend itself, unquote. I took that as a personal threat. I told him in response I'd had a good life, my will was made out, and I had thought through the risk and would take them when I was ready. He said that if I had to go off to jail, that the administration would help with the bail premiums. I advised him it was not a bail premium, but $100,000 straight cash. If that was a problem, I would have to worry about through family and friends. On the night before sentencing, Jack called me and said that the administration would provide the $100,000 in cash if I could tell him how to get it funded through an intermediary. I said if we ever needed it, I would let him know. I never contacted him thereafter, neither have I heard from him.
And that completes the statement.
I have one more question, Mr. McCord. Have you ever made that statement before this select committee, other than when you appeared before minority counsel and myself a couple of days ago? But have you ever made that statement before this committee, before the grand jury, or before any investigating body until this time?
No, sir.
Could you please state to the committee why, when you were making statements at earlier times before this committee, before the grand jury and other inquiring bodies, you failed to disclose that information?
I'd be glad to. To take the grand jury and get that one out of the way, when I appeared before the grand jury, I told them that they inquired about political pressure. I raised the pressure that had been put to me by the Hunts. And I told them as well that there was a personal friend who was involved also in political pressure against me. That personally, at that point in time, it was a very painful thing to go into it, that I would be glad to do it at a later time, and I hope they would defer that question until subsequent questioning, and I would be glad to answer it. They said they would do so. I believe when I appeared before the executive committee here on March 28th, that your senators asked me the same question, and then I said, yes, there had been political pressure applied to me, that one such pressure had been by a government. One of your senators asked me if it were by a government employee, I think Senator Montoya, and I responded yes, and he asked if it were anyone with the White House, and I said no. He asked if it were from the Department of Justice, and I said no. It was clear, I think, to the committee that I would like to be able to answer that question at a later time. The reason for the delay is that I wanted to be as accurate as I could about the information and get it all together, because it involved the President of the United States, in my opinion. And it was a very serious matter, and I wanted to be very careful about it and accurate.
I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCord, I'd like to limit my questions to one area, and that's what you know about the planning of the Watergate break-in. First of all, I'd like to separate what Mr. Hunt told you someone said about it from what Mr. Liddy told you someone said about it. Did Mr. Hunt indicate to you that he knew anything about these meetings that Mr. Liddy referred to with Mitchell, Magruder, and Dean?
Your question is, did Mr. Hunt
Yes, sir.
Indicate that he knew anything about the meetings?
Yes, sir.
Yes, he did.
What did he say about those meetings? Did he indicate that he was present in any of those meetings?
I'm trying to recall exactly the context of the discussions. If I may go into that, I will.
Yes, sir.
The meetings, as best I recall, in which these references by Mr. Hunt took place in Mr. Hunt's office in the Robert F. Mullen Company offices at 1700 Pennsylvania Avenue. They took place in April and May of 1972. To the best of my recollection, Mr. Liddy was present in all of the discussions. Mr. Liddy, during those discussions, as best I recall, would raise the topic of the planning and the progress of the operation itself, its going forward, and comments about what Mr. Mitchell was saying to him about what should be done in terms of the priorities of the operation, that is, which ones would be done first and second. And Mr. Hunt's comments, his exact words I can't recall, but his comments made to me, and not to me, made in the three-way discussion that were taking place during that period of time, indicated to me that he had separate, independent knowledge, perhaps from Mr. Liddy, perhaps from other sources of his own, that Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Dean and Mr. Magruder had planned the operations in the Attorney General's office to begin with, and that at least Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Magruder had had subsequent discussions after the first meeting in the Attorney General's office, and that Mr. Magruder and Mr. Mitchell had had discussions with Mr. Liddy and Mr. Mitchell's offices at the committee to re-elect the president regarding the ongoing plans to carry out the operations. Does this answer your question somewhat?
Well, I think it naturally raises several other questions. What did he say, as best you can recall, to indicate to you that he had any independent knowledge other than what Mr. Liddy might have told him?
I think he would refer to comments to Gordon as though, as you and I have discussed before.
Well, that would not fall in that category then
it would fall in that category.
As things that Mr. Hunt had learned separate and apart from what Mr. Liddy had told him?
It would fall in the category. I said two things. I said, one, what Mr. Liddy had told him before, and secondly, what it appeared to me he had learned from others. And I've mentioned to this committee a name of another individual, but I will not raise it at this point, that Mr. Hunt referred to in conversations in which we were talking about the Watergate operations and the planning for the operations.
Well,
and so on.
I previously referred
to the name of Mr. Colson. That was interjected into the conversation by Mr. Hunt in the meetings with Mr. Liddy and Mr. Hunt and me in his offices, Hunt's offices at 1700 Pennsylvania Avenue, and specifically when Mr. Hunt had a typed plan, operational plan for the entry of the Democratic National Committee headquarters. Thank you, Frank.
Do you recall anything that Mr. Hunt said to you about Mr. Colson's involvement, or did you just get the general impression that Mr. Colson was involved in some way from what Mr. Hunt told you?
I believe my previous testimony, which I will restate before this committee, was to the effect that when I had met Mr. Hunt in his offices at 1700 Pennsylvania Avenue with Mr. Liddy, that he had referred to his previous work at the White House for Mr. Colson, referring to him as his superior, that during the session that Mr. Hunt, Mr. Liddy and I had in Mr. Hunt's offices, Mr. Hunt had a typed plan that he had typed himself step by step for the entry of the Democratic National Committee headquarters, that at one point he held this plan in his hands. And his words were, he interjected the name of Mr. Colson into the conversation at that point. Words to the effect, "I will see Colson." And he held the paper in his hand in this sense. And from that statement, I drew the conclusion that he was going to see Mr. Colson and discuss or give him the operational plan.
Right.
That is a conclusion, but this is also the words, as best I recall, in which Mr. Hunt raised the name of Mr. Colson.
I'm sure that will need to be pursued, but getting back to my original point, is that independent knowledge that Mr. Hunt had of these meetings that we were referring to? He did not bring Mr. Colson into the conversation with regard to these particular meetings that you previously referred to, did he?
I believe you asked me if he appeared to have knowledge. I said that he appeared to have knowledge of the previous meetings of the Attorney General in the Attorney General's offices of Mr. Liddy, Mr. Magruder, and Mr. Dean. And my response was to the effect that he had it from Mr. Liddy, from what he told me. I believed also that he had this information from others.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, and I'm certainly not trying to. As a matter of fact, you say that you think he had independent knowledge, and of course this is a serious matter. I think we have to determine whether or not we're relying on Mr. Liddy or Mr. Hunt and Mr. Liddy for this information, which is of course extremely important information. Anything that you can state that Mr. Hunt told you to indicate that he had any independent knowledge of these meetings, I think would be very relevant. Whether you can do it now, or you supplied several memoranda, been very helpful in that regard, you want to do that at a subsequent time, I think that would be appropriate.
That would be helpful to you, and give it to you at the next meeting, and so forth in exact detail as I best recall.
All right. Anything that Hunt told you
indicating he knew about these meetings independent of what Liddy told him. Now, let's get back to the meetings in a little bit more detail, Mr. McCord. How many meetings did Mr. Liddy say there were when the overall surveillance operations were discussed?
At what point in time?
Well, how many meetings overall up until June the 17th did Mr. Liddy indicate that he, Mitchell, Magruder, and Dean, or any combination of these people, had to discuss general...
He didn't state the number. It was stated to me in various and sundry meetings with Mr. Liddy between January and June 17th by Mr. Liddy that he had had several meetings with Mr. Mitchell, that they appeared to be ongoing meetings with Mr. Mitchell from the planning stage until the completion of the plans for the second entry operation on June 17th. That there appeared to be continuous discussions between at least Mr. Liddy and Mr. Mitchell, and sometimes with Mr. Gruder, according to statements which Mr. Liddy made to me. And they began with the planning, and they continued through the ongoing operation itself, and the monitoring, and the planning for the second operation, and discussions at various stages, according to Mr. Liddy, of the various priorities of the bugging and photography operations, what was to come first, what was to come second.
Did Mr. Liddy come to you after each important meeting or after each meeting where these matters were discussed and give you a summary of the meeting and what was discussed and what the conclusions were?
Not after each meeting at all, but we would see each other regularly during the week. I'd say if not once a day, at least every other day, most weeks between January and June 17th. Sometimes he would tell me, I'm getting ready to go up to see the Attorney General to discuss this operation, referring to the Watergate operation, to discuss the operations that he had planned. Sometimes he would tell me, I've just come back from that operation and here's what we're going to do now.
Were some of these meetings, according to him, according to what he told you, while Mr. Mitchell was still Attorney General?
Yes.
And some after he came to the committee to reelect?
Yes.
Were money figures discussed?
Oh, yes.
According to what he said. According to Mr. Liddy, what was the original proposed budget for the overall surveillance operation? I assume we are talking about the overall operation and not just the Watergate break-in. Is that correct?
Talking about three categories, political espionage, photography operations, and the electronic operations. And the original figure in February that Mr. Liddy proposed, as I saw in writing, in a draft on his desk at one occasion and in a typed memorandum on a second occasion, was approximately $450,000.
All right. Was, according to him, was that budget approved?
The sequence of the events were that there were planning meetings in January or February, or both, in the Attorney General's offices, in which Mr. Dean and Mr. Magruder, Mr. Liddy, and Mr. Mitchell discussed the original amount, the $450,000 amount, and subsequently, approximately 30 days after the first, quote, formal meeting that I heard referred to by Mr. Liddy, there was a figure of approximately $250,000, which he said had been approved for the operation, and he referred also to some additional funds which he had in the order of approximately $100,000, though that figure is not absolutely certain in my mind, which would total about something around $300,000, $350,000.
According to him, was this money problem, the need for subsequent meetings, was that a concern of the people involved? Was there quite a bit of discussion as to exactly how much money should be spent on this project?
Money was a topic that he said was discussed. He said the individual operations were discussed, that is, specifically the three parts of his budget, which he had prepared on charts, which he had taken to at least one of the meetings. That is the three parts of political espionage and photography and so on. It was not limited, the discussion was not limited to the matter of funding. My understanding was all aspects of the operations were discussed in those meetings by the four individuals.
Let me just ask you this. Did he tell you that John Mitchell ever told him that this budget is just too high and you'll have to do it for less or something
no.
to that extent?
No, he did not.
Did he ever tell you that they specifically discussed the Watergate operation in any of these meetings?
Which meetings are you referring to?
I'm talking about any meetings which he had with the Attorney General when any of these other people were present.
Oh, yes. Sure.
That the Watergate break-in specifically was discussed.
Very definitely.
What did he say about that particular discussion?
It was a continuous discussion, he said, with Mr. Magruder from the earliest planning session in February through the first entry operation Memorial Day weekend and then into the second operation in June. And he talked to me at various times, and it was clear from what he said that occurred to me that Mr. Liddy was having such meetings. He stated that he was having such meetings in which the Watergate operation was a part, Watergate referring to the Democratic National Committee headquarters itself. So I would say there were many such discussions by Mr. Liddy with me in which he stated that meetings had occurred with Mr. Mitchell and Magruder specifically on this after February.
I think that one of the areas that has not been covered is the role of the person who was on the other side of the wiretap, which you installed in May, the end of May of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you employ Mr. Baldwin, Mr. Alfred Baldwin, for that purpose?
Yes, I did.
And what was his particular assignment with regard to monitoring the wiretap?
His assignment was to listen on a radio receiver that received the transmissions from the Democratic National Committee telephones in which the electronic devices had been installed in connection with the two dates of Memorial Day weekend and June 17th, 1972.
Where was he located when he was doing this monitoring?
On the seventh floor of the Howard Johnson Motel, across the street from the Democratic National Committee headquarters.
Now, Mr. Court, can you see the chart?
National Committee headquarters.
Now, Mr. Court, can you see the chart on the easel there?
Yes.
Now, the picture purports to show the Howard Johnsons on your right and the Watergate office building on your left. Now, does it represent the room 723, which was used by Mr. Baldwin for the monitoring of
yes,
those
steps? Yes, it does.
And he was then just right across the street and
that
doing
right.
that. In his monitoring, how was he recording what he was hearing?
He would listen with headphones to the conversations that were being transmitted and would take down the substance of the conversations, the time, the date, on a yellow legal-sized scratch pad, and then ultimately would type them up, a summary of them, by time, chronological summary, and turn that type log into me, and I would deliver them to Mr. Liddy.
Did you deliver them to Mr. Liddy directly?
Yes.
Now?
Yes.
Now, did there come a time when you were delivering those logs that they were retyped?
I know of at least one instance in which that occurred because I saw them being retyped.
Was it your understanding that that occurred on more than one occasion, even though you yourself
yes.
may not have known? What was the purpose of retyping the log? Did Mr. Liddy explain that to you?
I believe some general explanation in substance that he wanted them in a more final, complete form for discussion with Mr. Mitchell and whoever else received them.
Now, who did this retyping?
Sally Harmony, H-A-R-M-O-N-Y, who is the secretary to Mr. Liddy,
at the Committee for the Re-election of the President.
And did you have occasion to observe her typing the log?
Yes, I did.
Did you have occasion to talk to her while she was doing it?
Yes, I did.
And in that conversation you had with Sally Harmony, did she give you any indication that she understood what she was doing when she was retyping that log?
Yes, she did.
As a matter of fact, could you briefly describe, without going into any of the contents, what a log would be, what actually would be entered on the log, which Mr. Baldwin would first type and be retyped by Ms. Harmony?
It would be similar to any other telephone conversation that one person might make to another, beginning with a statement on his log of the time of the call, who was calling whom, a summary of what was said during the conversation itself, including names of persons who were mentioned that Mr. Baldwin apparently believed was of sufficient significance to set forth on the log.
Then it would be true that anybody reading that would have no difficulty knowing it came from a telephone conversation.
That's correct.
Now, I think you testified earlier, and I just wanted to get it clear for the record, that your discussions with Mr. Liddy concerning meetings he had with the Attorney General indicated that Mr. Liddy was actually meeting with the Attorney General with regard to this operation.
That is correct.
All the way up till what time? What was the last date that Mr. Liddy indicated that he had a meeting with the Attorney General regarding this particular bugging operation?
My best recollection is immediately before June 17th, I would estimate during that week immediately preceding June 17th.
Did Mr. Liddy indicate what the nature of that meeting was?
All I can recall at this point is some conversation as a general conversation to the effect that we discussed getting ready for the operation that's coming up, and I think just the overall planning for the operation.
Going back very briefly to the information that you were getting from the Internal Security Division, Was your trip to Miami related in any way to the Department of Justice's investigation of the veterans for the against the war of Vietnam?
No.
Was your any of the investigation that you engaged in with regard to that group related to the Department of Justice investigation?
In Miami, you mean?
Or any other place?
I'm sorry, would you mind restating that question? I'm not sure I quite follow it.
I think in your testimony you indicated that information you were receiving from the Internal Security Division and other information related in some respects to activities of the veterans against the war of Vietnam.
Yes.
Was your activity in getting that information or any investigation you were conducting on behalf of the committee related in any way to any investigation the Department of Justice was making with the same group?
If by that it's meant that whatever information I was acquiring separate and apart from the Internal Security Division was being transmitted back to them, the answer would be no. It was a one-way street, it was at that time.
Now, you've named in the second break-in of the Watergate four persons in addition to the involvement of Mr. Lydian Hunt, and you named Mr. Barker, Mr. Martinez, Mr. Sturgis, Mr. Gonzalez. I think you also mentioned that in the first break-in there were three additional persons. Could you name them for the record, please?
I don't know that I know the names for certain. I have been shown some photographs by the
FBI, if you want me to relate that.
You do not know the names of your own? Now, have you identified photographs of persons who did accompany you in the first?
I've seen two photographs of men that I believed were in that first operation.
As a result of that identification, did you then learn what their names were?
I heard the names. The names that I originally, what I'm trying to say is the names I originally heard were apparently not the true names, so I can't associate the two together that way. But the photographs, one individual was, I believe, that I made a probable identification of was a Mr. Felipe Di Diego. And the other name associated with the photograph that identified was a Mr. Reinaldo, R-E-I-N-A-L-D-O, Pico, P-I-C-O.
Now, Mr. McCord, I've had placed at your table a telephone which is not connected to anything. And what I would like you to do, because you've testified with regard to a particular bugging operation at Democratic National Committee headquarters, if you would demonstrate to the committee the manner in which you placed the so-called bug in the telephone, and would I please like to ask the party with the custody of the receiver to please take the receiver over to the table.
My counsel asked for assurance that I won't be prosecuted on this installation.
As I said, the telephone's connected, is not connected, and no conversation is being involved. Now, I also will. Show you a item which was entered as an exhibit. As Exhibit 16B at the trial, and I understand was taken from either your possession or in the vicinity of where you were when you were arrested, and I think is a miniature transmitter, a microphone, and ask if you would identify that.
Yes, I believe this is the one entered into evidence.
Yes. Now, would you identify exactly what that is?
This is a radio, essentially a radio transmitter, which is powered by the power within the telephone system, the telephone line itself. And this transmitter was for the purpose of being connected into the telephone itself, for the purpose of transmitting those conversations over the phone.
When that transmitter is connected in the telephone, is it capable of picking up both sides of the conversation and broadcasting it to another place?
Yes, it is.
Could you just demonstrate, not actually attaching it, how you would place that in that telephone that's before you?
The cover would be taken off of the telephone.
Could you lift the base a little so that the Senate committee can see what you're doing?
Cover would be taken off of the telephone.
I have no further questions.
This will be my first for this day. Who made arrangements for you to receive, as you say, on virtually a daily basis, documents from the Internal Security Division of the Department of Justice?
Mr. Robert Mardian made the contact with, as I understood it, with the Internal Security Division, where he had formerly worked.
Now, at that time he made the contact, he was working for the committee to re-elect the president, having retired from his Justice Department job.
Yes, sir.
He had been the head of that particular division of the Department of Justice before he transferred to the committee.
So
So I understood, yes, sir.
Now, when Mr. Caulfield came to see you, when he met you on three occasions, or took you out twice on George Washington Parkway and one time towards Warrenton, Virginia, was he driving his own automobile or a government automobile?
I believe he was driving his own automobile, I'm sure. Yes,
sir. That's all. Anything further?
Yes, sir. Mr. McCord, I know you've been here a long time, and I appreciate that fact. But I do have a couple of rather pointed questions I'd like to ask you. I don't fancy myself in the role as a prosecutor or a defense lawyer, but I feel like there are a couple of things that I need to ask you about. The questions are going begging, and I plan to do so in that spirit, and I'm sure you understand. Mr. McCord, there was some previous testimony concerning the use of tape on the locks of the doors at the Democratic National Committee. Mm-hmm. And you testified in response, I believe last Friday, in response to a question from Senator Baker, who placed the tape on the locks on the door on the second occasion. And you responded, "I do not know," the second occasion being the June 17 break-in, as opposed to the first occasion, I believe you said was May 27. According to the civil deposition that you gave on April 30, 1973, a suit brought by the Democratic National Committee against you and others, on page 167 of that deposition, your testimony is related as follows. The reason for checking it, first of all, on the way over, I checked the back door of the DNC, or the Watergate Hotel office building, basement level. The reason for checking it is that at the earlier meeting, earlier that evening, it had been decided that I would be elected to go into the DNC and tape the doors so that there could be ready access for them to get in. And the men with the locksmith wouldn't have to pick a series of doors to get in. I did that. It took perhaps 10 minutes. Could you explain that discrepancy?
Sure. Because I believe your question was stated, who taped the lock on the second occasion that they were taped? At least I understood the question that way. On June 17th, they were taped on two different occasions. And my response, if it was not clear, was intended to convey this idea, that I taped it on the first occasion that they were taped on the evening of June 17th, and that someone else did the second taping that evening, perhaps an hour or so later. Among the other four men, the other four defendants, just which one did so, I don't know. That's what I was trying to convey.
I see. How many doors were taped the second time?
I think there were several, because there are several doors that normally would be taped, perhaps a half a dozen or more. There's about three down on the lower level, and then there's some doors up entering the corridors from perhaps fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh floors that I would believe were taped that evening.
Had the tape been removed on those doors?
I don't know about the corridor doors. They were not removed when I saw them on the lower level doors, the three or four down there.
Of course, there would be no need to retape them had not the tape been removed, would there?
Let's see if I understand your question. There'd be no reason to retape them?
To tape the doors a second time if the first tape had not been removed.
No, that's correct. That's correct.
Right, you heard Officer Schaffler, I believe, Mr. McCord, testify last week that when the doors were locked there at the DNC, that one could get out of an office building without a key or without having the door taped. Could you explain, first of all, what was the need to tape the doors once you were inside? And secondly, why did no one seemingly have the presence of mind to remove the tape on the B2 level and leave it there for the officer to find?
Well, I think you almost have to see the different doors involved to be able to understand that situation, and it involves this. There are there are some stairwells coming down off of different floors, and even stairwells, I believe, off of the same floor, say on the sixth or seventh, that coil down like a rope. That is, you may go on into the stairwell off of the corridor from one exit, and it'll go down one stairwell, and you go around the corner, and you go down another one, and it'll go down a separate stairwell, and the two of them wind down. Now, some of those doors are, at night, locked from both sides, as I recall, so that some are not, but let me correct that. Some are locked from the inside. In other words, were locked. So that if you were trying to get out of the corridor down into a stairwell late at night, you couldn't get in to the stairwell. But you might be able to go up a couple of floors, say to the eighth floor, and I think there was a door open there, and you would have to come down and then go into, say you wanted to get back down to the sixth floor and go into the corridor, go into that door from the stairwell side, you could get in. So that door, for example, would have to be taped. If you had in mind getting out in a hurry and getting down, you'd have to be taped from the, you'd have to go into it from the stairwell side first. Some of these other doors locked from both sides.
I believe you're right,
Mr. McCord. It's a pretty complex story.
I believe you're right. You'd almost have to be there to understand it.
You would. It's pretty complex.
Is this the reason the eighth floor door was taped on this occasion, June 17th?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Did you personally check out the doors, check the situation to determine whether or not tape would be needed on particular doors before you went in to tape those doors, or did anyone check it out?
Well, we knew from the previous operation on Memorial Day that they would have to be taped if you're going to plan to leave in a hurry. If you got caught there, for example, if the police came in on you before you got in, you'd have to tape the doors, or otherwise you couldn't be sure that you could get out.
What about the answer to the second part of my question? Here you are with, of course, you are an experienced man in the CIA and FBI, and evidently these other men were experienced in their own way, and yet the tape to the B2 level, readily accessible to anyone coming by there to check, as the officer did, was left on the door. You didn't remove the tape. Why was that done? And secondly, why was the risk taken to go back up into the DNC with no means of escape, evidently, once you were caught, after you had seen that someone had removed the tape, and for all practical purposes, you had to assume that someone was aware that somebody was trying to get in or had already gotten in?
Mm-hmm.
Why was that decision made to start with? Why was the decision made to go back in there after you knew someone knew that you'd been tampering with that door?
All right, it's a good question because we had a lot of discussions on it later. We,
where?
In jail. We came by the lower level door that had originally been taped, assuming that the tape was still there and we could get right on in without any delay. This is all of the five men together getting ready to go up into the Democratic National Committee headquarters. We found that tape had been taken off and that the door was now locked, speaking of the basement level. So we regrouped, so to speak, right below the restaurant in the Watergate Hotel and talked over what to do. And it was agreed that the locksmith and I believe one or two of the men would go back over and make an effort to pick the lock to get in. And that
why was that decision reached?
Well,
after you knew that someone had detected your being there previously.
All right, let me add. The decision was this, to send the locksmith back over and let him start to work in order that there not be any more delay in time. And for the other, the men, Barker and I believe one other, to go back up to Mr. Hunt's room and discuss the situation with Mr. Hunt and Mr. Liddy in terms of what do they feel we should do next. Should they go ahead and pick them, or try to pick the lock and get on in, or should it be called off? And for me to go back over to the motel, wait for word on what was to be done. Understood that this was a calculated risk in sending them back over to begin picking the lock. But on the other hand, the more time that went by, the fewer people there would be around the Watergate Hotel, and the more conspicuous the men would be, and therefore that had some risk in terms of delaying the matter any further. So it was sort of decided to go both directions, to go ahead and start to get in, and go back up and talk it over with Hunt and Liddy and see what they wanted to do.
Who made the ultimate decision as to whether or not you were going back in that night? You say that there were risks in waiting. You mean waiting any later that night, or waiting until another day or another week, or what?
Well, there were risks in waiting any longer that night, for example.
Well, why not call the whole thing off and come back in two or three nights?
Well,
it looks like a pretty good idea now, I guess, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Very good. It was made on the basis that, first of all, as I say, any further delay in time made five men stand out that much more that night. Any delay in time that night made five men stand out that much more around the hotel and around the Watergate office building. Therefore, rather than lose that time, the decision was to go both directions, to go ahead and send the locksmith back over and let him start to work on it, and let the other two men go up and talk it over with Lydia and Hunt and see what they wanted to do. Did they want to proceed or not?
Right. Let me ask you a question in regard to another subject. As I understand, your testimony has been that, I believe on July 27 of 1972, you received your first payment from Mrs. Hunt, I believe $15,000, mm-hmm. and that was to do you through November, I believe.
Right.
That you received from some additional money in December, which was to be payment in advance for the rest of December and January.
Yes, that's correct.
Do you recall the date of the payment in December?
I believe it was the 2nd of December.
December the 2nd?
Yes.
You mentioned the letter that you wrote to Mr. Caulfield, the anonymous letter in December. Do you recall the date in December of that letter?
No, I can only remember the week, which was a week following Christmas, December 25th.
Latter part of December.
Yes.
So your letter to Mr. Caulfield was after you had received the December 2 payment?
Yes. Right.
And what was that payment? How much money was it?
It was for the two months' payment for the salary for December, and for, I think, additional money, $13,000 for lawyer's fees.
Was there some question in the latter part of November or during December as to whether or not additional money would be forthcoming?
Yes, there was. There was a question on Hunt's part, and Mrs. Hunt communicated that question to me. I think that probably had something to do with the letter that he wrote that I've described, a three-page letter that was read to one of the lawyers.
Did it have anything to do with your letter that you wrote to Caulfield?
None whatever. My letter had to do with my anger about this plan to lay this operation on CIA, and I think the letter sort of indicates that.
Mr. McCord, you have stated that you were concerned from sometime shortly before the trial, I believe, up until recently, that the trial was a sham, that the trial was fixed, that it was a miscarriage of justice. And I assume that you're talking about essentially the fact that some of the right people were not being prosecuted and you were not being treated right with regard to full disclosure by the government. Is that essentially correct?
I think I can state it more precisely. It was a fact that there was perjured testimony in the trial itself by a key witness. That key witness was Mr. Jeb Magruder. His testimony was throughout the whole trial.
Pardon me just a minute. The basis on which you say his testimony was perjured, was perjury, I assume has to do with what Mr. Liddy has told you about Mr. Magruder. Is that not correct?
Told me before June 17th and the comments we exchanged at the time Mr. Magruder was up on the stand stating that he knew nothing about the Watergate operation prior to June 17th.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
All right. Go ahead.
So that was the basis of
No, not statements. Quite. Not completely.
Right.
There is also the factor that Mr. Magruder, in addition to testifying that he knew nothing about the Watergate operation, and his testimony being probably that of the most important witness in the trial, also could have named others who were principals in the case, specifically Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Dean, according to the information I had from Mr. Lydian, which I had no doubt about.
You could have too, couldn't you?
I could have too, right.
Why didn't you?
All right, glad to talk that one over too. Why didn't I get on the stand?
Yes, I think that's a fair question. It seems to me, again, if we might preface that a little bit, according to the statement of your attorneys at the time, Mr. Alt, your defense was that essentially, as you stated to Senator Baker here today, that you felt like that because of the violence in the country and so forth, it actually posed a threat, possibly your life and the lives of other people. That's in the record, according
sure.
to Mr. Alt.
Sure.
I take it your defense was not that at that time, part of your motivation was not, as you have stated here before this committee, that you thought you had had the right possibly to go ahead without being in legal difficulty because mm-hmm. Mr. Mitchell's involvement, because Mr. Dean's involvement.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what you've told us, but evidently you didn't tell Mr. Alts that. Mr. Alts didn't use that as part of your defense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about the answer to those questions. Why didn't you come forward at that time, and why didn't you tell Mr. Alts what could have been an even more significant part of your defense at that time?
Well, I'd had many conversations with Mr. Alt about the facts of the case and the other principles involved. The decision of mine as to when to come forward with the information which I did was basically my decision, and it was a day-at-a-time decision on my part as to when was the propitious time to tell the facts on this case.
And you waited until...
I waited until I had an opportunity to tell, number one, a man I believe to be an honest judge, Judge Sirica, number two, to tell this committee so that there would be the proper forum for all of the facts to come out and to be discovered. I felt, for example, during the trial itself, that if I'd come forward and told the story at that point in time, in light of the nature of the information I had, which some people have described as hearsay or secondhand, the rules of evidence, as I understand it, may have excluded some of that information being provided in testimony, or at least I felt that all of the facts would not be developed during the trial if I got up on the stand and related them. To me, it was a matter of when was the right time to tell it. And this was the most difficult decision. It was not influenced by money or anything else. It was influenced by basically my own reasoning as to when was the right time to tell the story so that there would be an adequate forum for development of all of the facts in the case. And I think my decision has been the right one. I think I told Judge Sirica first, and I told this committee second, and I'm fully convinced that that was the right decision.
Was there any doubt in your mind that if you'd come forward at that time to Judge Sirica, that he would not have taken the appropriate action and that the matter would not have been handled? According to the trial transcript, Judge Sirica practically pleads with anyone to come forward and tell the truth. He states here on page 1499 of the trial transcript, if they know anything about this case, they want to talk before the grand jury, it's not too late. That's up to them. I mean, I always operate under the theory that the truth never hurts anybody. If they wait and they're convicted and then they decide to talk, well, I can't say anything about that, but I think if they're going to talk, or if there's anything in their minds along those lines, the time for him to do it is during the trial.
Mm-hmm.
He was stating that.
Mm-hmm.
And was there any doubt in your mind that you would be compromised in any way if you went forward and told Judge Sirica in January?
Not Judge Sirica in the least. He's sort of the lone man I felt I could depend on in this whole case. And I have...
He's also the man who will be sentencing you shortly.
That's true, too. That's true, too. But what I'm saying about my belief in the man is honest and genuine. But you asked my reasons, and my reasons were the ones I've stated. And I think the decision as to the timing of saying what I did was right, and I don't regret that decision. I believe, as I've said, if I'd done it earlier, that, quite frankly, the facts would not have come out and been developed as they have and been developed by this committee in the way that they have.
But you were, of course, receiving money during this period of time also, weren't you?
I received money on December 2nd,
which went through January 2nd,
but that, quite frankly, as I told the people who were sending it, had no bearing on what I was going to say and when I was going to say it.
Were your conversations with Mr. Caulfield, did the possibility that you could get your case maybe thrown out of court because of a wiretap, did that enter into your decision to hold out?
No.
And not come forward?
No, it did not.
Weren't you trying at that time with Mr. Caulfield to get him to get the government to admit illegal wiretaps so that your case would be thrown out?
Oh, yes. Now, let me repeat what I've said before so it's as clear as I know how to make it. I said I thought the case was a sham, that the trial was a sham because of the perjured testimony, because of the withholding of highly material information by Jeb Magruder, which would involve higher-ups in the case, number one, and perjury, number two, which means that we were not getting a fair trial. And I said this in many ways to Jack, that I felt that we ought to, justice, so far as I was concerned, demanded that the case be kicked out and we start all over again on this thing, and start all over in a circumstance that, number one, we'd get a fair trial.
Well,
we're not getting a fair trial if perjury is being committed by a key witness.
You were interested in your fair trial, which, of course, is your constitutional right.
For all of the defendants.
Did Mr. Magruder's failure to, in your eyes, tell the truth about it, did that prejudice your case?
Absolutely. If he is a key witness and all other testimony seems to fall into place around his testimony, and he is withholding the names of principals in the case itself,
in other words,
I'd say that prejudices the case, and it puts a completely, totally different light on the case. In other words, the trial itself was appearing to indicate that Mr. Liddy was the sum total of this operation. He was the leader, the director, the funder, the whole package, and that the case cut off at his level. It did not. The case obviously extended much higher.
In other words, Mr. Magruder could have come in and implicated higher-ups so that you wouldn't have to. Is that the way in which his testimony prejudiced your case?
And he could prove it.
So that's the way you looked at that. Because, of course, I assume there was no controversy over the fact that you were caught with four other men huddled behind a desk with burglary tools on you and eavesdropping equipment.
No argument about that at all, but I felt that under any circumstances, the least a man deserves is a fair trial.
Absolutely.
And that we were not getting it.
Absolutely. You mentioned your calls in September and October to the Chilean embassy and the Israeli embassy. This, of course, was... let me ask you this. What was the purpose of those particular phone calls?
I think I've previously stated, if not, I'll restate it, to try to test... Try to test the accuracy of the government's response regarding intercepted conversations of mine. I was concerned that there had been wiretapping since June 17th of my telephone conversations. And this would provide a test to see if, in fact, all of the government records of the government, some 12 agencies, had, in fact, been searched. The inferences by the response of the government 14 days after a motion was filed was, there is nothing on the record in the government of any interception of Mr. McCord's calls anywhere. And I knew that, as I've stated, it takes more than 14 days normally to search 12 different government agencies for records of such telephone calls.
How was this a test, Mr. McCord? Did you think or did you know that these two embassies had been bugged?
I assumed that they were.